Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 127 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest is one of the most beautiful and talented young actresses working in Hollywood today, Emma Stone. The 28-year-old currently is the toast of the town for her portrayal of an aspiring young actress in La La Land, and, as our conversation makes clear, the journey that her character takes over the course of that massively acclaimed film is not at all unlike the one that led her from Arizona to the Academy Awards. Since making her big-screen debut a decade ago as a scene-stealer in the raunchy comedy Superbad, the quantity and quality of Stone's work has been astonishing. She became a fan favorite thanks to her first solo leading role in 2010's Easy A. She helped to carry a blockbuster, 2009's Zombieland, and a comic book franchise through 2012's The Amazing Spider-Man and its 2014 sequel, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. She played key parts of the ensembles of 2011's Best Picture Oscar-nominated The Help and 2014's Best Picture Oscar-winning Birdman, garnering a Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination for the latter. She starred on Broadway from late 2014 through early 2015 in Cabaret, while anchoring Woody Allen movies in those same years. And she provided one half of a magical, modern-day Astaire and Rogers-like screen couple in three hit films opposite Ryan Gosling: 2011's Crazy Stupid Love, 2013's Gangster Squad, and most recently, 2016's La La Land, which has been nominated for a record-tying 14 Oscars, among them one for her in the category of Best Actress. I sat down with Stone at the Biltmore Hotel in Santa Barbara, and over the course of our conversation, she and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how acting helped her to overcome the debilitating anxiety that she suffered as a kid, what led to her moving out to Hollywood at the age of 15, which filmmaker encouraged her to begin dyeing her natural blonde hair red, how she grew as an actor through working with everyone from Jonah Hill to Alejandro González Iñárritu, why, despite her Broadway experience, she required a lot of convincing that she was capable of starring in Damien Chazelle's original movie musical, what some of the specific ways were in which she and her collaborators poured their hearts and souls into La La Land, and what she makes of its phenomenal success, and so much more. It's a fun hour with an amazing young star, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Thank you very much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And to begin with, we always just ask, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Scottsdale, Arizona, which is a suburb of Phoenix. And my dad was general contractor, and my mom originally worked in publicity, basically, but then just became my it's a tough job to raise my brother and me, but was our mom, yeah.
Right. So I was trying to do some homework about you, prepare for this. So I read, and I'm sure there may be things that I came across that are not correct, so fix that if I say anything wrong, but I read that you had a lot of sort of anxiety issues as a kid, and that the only way they started to really go away was when you found acting as an outlet. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say, but it's also, my brother has recently redrawn my attention to what I was like before the anxiety hit, which was putting on a lot of shows that he had to play a lot of parts in. Yeah. So around, you know, 4 or 5, I was definitely singing and dancing and putting on shows, and was, I think, in his words, bossy, which now is a banned word, right, from the kind of female vernacular. Right. I was just very focused.
Okay.
But anxiety hit me pretty hard around 6 or 7. And yeah, I had my first panic attack when I was 7. So then that locked me up for a couple of years, and I remembered I was in my first grade play, and that was so fantastic. And then I had a couple of years of a pretty rough ride.
Like, it was debilitating.
It was debilitating, yeah.
So what was it, though, that first grade thing was like an actual turning point there, was in terms of just you immediately responding to being a performer? Or what was it about that appealed to you?
That was my first time being legitimately on stage in elementary school, mm-hmm, in the cafetorium.
Yes.
You know? So I think it was a combination of factors. I think that performing had always been something just really fun for me, and that sort of came naturally in a sense from a young age. But I think being with all the kids were older than me in the play. They were all in fifth grade, and right, I was in first grade. So there was that kind of instant feeling of being, you know, with the older cool kids.
Right, right.
And I had seen a tape back a couple years ago, and I'm just, you know, staring at the girl that plays my sister and just doing exactly what she does. And I just the biggest smile on my face because I don't know. I just had such a blast. It was just something that totally transported me. And
well, you could get out of your own
head. I was so present. Yeah, it was so much fun. And then, you know, audience reaction and laughter or anything like that was just really, I just loved the feeling of the energy of the room.
So it seems like once you started doing it, you really knew that this was what you wanted to do. And the question that I had is if you can brief us on a couple of these presentations that I read about. There were a couple of moments where you really went to bat for your cause.
Well, there was one when I was about 12. After my sixth, I went to public elementary school, mm-hmm. and the first year of public school, middle school, and I made a little presentation for my parents because I had started acting at Valley Youth Theater in Phoenix and doing the plays, and I asked to be homeschooled.
Mm-hmm. How was that received?
It was received, you know, it took a lot of, I think, conversation amongst them. Yeah. And then as a student, I was a perfectionist and I really wanted to get good grades and very, very hard on myself, which you can probably imagine with an anxious kid. Mm-hmm. Even if I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing, I was very obsessed with getting it right. And so I loved learning, but there were other things that I really, you know, wanted to focus on. And I was so, so into acting, mm-hmm. that I really wanted to do a bunch of plays. So that was kind of my pitch. And then I was homeschooled for 2 years, which thankfully, because I don't think, and then I ended up going back to an all-girls Catholic private high school. Mm-hmm. And within the first semester, I sort of was struck with this thought of moving to Los Angeles. Right. I was an insane kid. So long story short, you guys.
You had vision for a kid. This is pretty amazing.
It was a lot.
And that was presentation number two.
And that was presentation number two. Yeah, when I was 14.
And the argument there was like, Mom, I need you to pack it up and join me or what?
Well, we'd had someone who's like our big sister named Chrissy, Spencer and I, my brother and I, and she's 11 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And so she was in her mid-20s at this point. And so the idea was, hey, Mom, we could just go for pilot season. I mean, although I didn't really know what pilot season was at this point. So it was really just let's move to LA. But she was like, okay. So once we looked at it, she didn't say okay right away. It took a long time. But once we looked into it, we understood what pilot season was, which sort of gave it a shorter window, you know, maybe we'll just be there for 3 months. And so she would come out for a week and then Chrissy would come out for the next week and she'd be home with my brother.
Yeah.
And my dad, you know, was with my brother in Arizona.
So you're 15 when you first get out to LA, and just because there are obvious parallels with La La Land, let's just, if we can set the scene a little bit.
Yeah.
Where were you living?
Park La Brea.
Right. These are sort of these like, what, two bedroom apartments near Hollywood.
Yeah.
And you moved out with or without representation?
Part of the rule that my parents had put in place was that I was not going to move to LA without representation. If it was going to happen, we needed to figure that out first. So it wasn't just, you know, kind of sitting in an apartment as a 15-year-old.
Twiddling your thumbs.
Being homeschooled. Right, yeah, exactly. So I worked with an acting coach in Arizona who had some ties to this kind of a kids agency in Los Angeles. And I went in and did, you know, a dramatic monologue and a comedic monologue for them. And they signed me and they sent me out for the first couple of months.
And those first couple of months, how did they go?
Nothing happened. I went in and auditioned for probably any sitcom you can imagine. And then none of that worked out. And so they just stopped sending me out.
So how did you get the extension basically beyond pilot season? What was the conversation there?
I was just really pretty, again, focused, mm-hmm, I guess, mm-hmm. on it. Just felt deep down, as kind of strange as that is to be a kid on your own out there, because I really didn't have a ton of friends, mm-hmm. out there, or I really didn't know many people. I just really, really felt that this eventually somehow would come together. And so I said, can we keep doing this? And there was enough faith built up that I really truly meant it at that point. So I got a job at a dog bakery,
which is
farmer's market.
Yes, this is like basically making food for dogs, right?
This is making food for dogs. Yes. And then my mom saw a commercial on TV for a reality search competition for the new Partridge Family.
Yes.
And I hadn't been on an audition at this point, I think in two or like probably 2 months. And she said, I really have, and my mom has never done this before and never has again. She said, I really, really have a good feeling about this for some reason. And I was like, are you out of your mind? I am not going to do that. And she was like, just go to this audition. Right. Let's see, because I have this weird feeling. Right. And so I did.
That was the first one you booked.
That was In Search of the New Partridge Family.
Auspicious starts.
That's right.
So when and why did Emily Stone, which I believe is your actual name, become first Riley and then Emma? What was this evolution?
So when I first went to get my SAG card, Emily Stone was taken. And so they, you know, suggested Emily J. Stone or Emily Jean Stone, which is my middle name. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, as a 16-year-old at this point, I was like, or I can pick a brand new name. And how cool is that going to be? I mean, ask any 16-year-old if they want to pick a new name legally. Right. It's probably a yes. Maybe not. I don't mean to speak for all of you if you're 16 out there and you love your name. But I was like, Emily, everybody's got that name.
Right.
So I chose Riley, which is a cool-ass name.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, and then I had it for a little bit. And I remember someone calling me on set. I did a guest part either on Malcolm in the Middle or Medium. Mm-hmm. And someone said my name and I was just totally, I had no idea who they were talking to. And so I realized I needed to change it. And Emma was, you know, closer to Emily than anything else. So I still prefer being called Emily.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. By your friend. That's what your friends and family call you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, people could just call me Em because it's an easier, you know.
Shorter.
Yeah.
So those first few jobs out there were on TV, kind of little parts on TV. Malcolm in the Middle, as you mentioned, Life of Zack and Cody, some of these other things. I think probably more memorable for you and certainly for Louis C.K. was something on Lucky Louie, right?
Yep.
You were 16 and had to go in there and...
Had to go in there and offer to blow him. That's what you wanted to say, but you couldn't say it.
Well, you know.
It was really... And he was so protective and sweet and just, you know, great about it. But my God, it was an intense thing for a 16-year-old to be doing.
And by the way, at that point, Louis C.K. wasn't Louis C.K. is.
Today. Yeah, it was the first, I think, ever totally uncensored sitcom with a live studio audience. And yeah, it was very interesting.
But so you were getting some traction here. But then I guess the big break, would you say, was... when somebody who you'd been auditioning for years, like finally comes up with something that actually, you know, I guess my sense was that you'd been auditioning without much clicking with this person, the casting director, Allison Jones. And then how did the one that actually did finally work, how did that come to your attention that there was an opportunity?
I had auditioned for her, I want to say for the first time when I had moved when I was 15. And I think quite a few times over the years, there was a pilot that I actually tested for, which is, that's what they don't tell you, that testing for a pilot is sometimes worse than getting a no on the first time. You know, when you go in like three or four times and you really think this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember testing for this pilot and really thinking it was going to work out. And Allison was so supportive and then it didn't. And I was just so bummed. And so when I was 17, almost 18, after a couple of years, she called me in for a movie and I went in on a Saturday and she put me on tape and she just said she had a good feeling about it. Again, those good feelings, you got to trust that good feeling. My mom had it.
Right.
And so she called me and it was for Superbad and ended up going and improvising with Jonah. And
which, by the way, was that something, I know you had done a lot of comedy in the youth theater stuff, but was improvising something you were comfortable with?
Yes, there was an improv troupe at my youth theater.
Okay.
So improv and sketch comedy was something that I just loved so much.
So this was a cool opportunity, actually.
It was fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean, we did the scene and then they kind of just, you know, asked us to go for it. So I think for, you know, half an hour or something, we were just kind of playing around with stuff. And Judd Apatow was there and Greg Mottola, our director. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of this wild time. And it honestly took months for it to come together. We did a table read with Jonah playing various male characters because I think they thought maybe he was too old or something for Seth. And then eventually it happened, but it took a couple months to come to fruition.
It took a couple months for you to know that you had your part as well.
Yes.
Because that's another one where they could get your hopes
up.
Yeah,
I think I auditioned in April and we shot in like August or something.
Wow.
It was a while.
And that did really give you a great chance to show your comedic abilities. And I think another thing that came out of that was that Judd Apatow kind of had a cosmetic suggestion about how you should move forward.
Well, Martha McIsaac, who's my best friend to this day, who played Becca in Superbad, was brunette. Mm-hmm. And so Judd was like, well, you know, we got to make your hair red. And I was like, red? And my mom's a redhead. So I was like, all right, well, let's try it.
That was the start of that.
And now it's stuck on me. Yes. But I am a blonde.
Fun fact. So in the aftermath of that, there were, in fairly rapid succession, The House Bunny, Ghosts of Girlfriends Past, Paper Man, Zombieland, and then the one that I think you've described in other interviews as sort of like a turning point. It has to have been, because you were now for the first time in basically every scene of a movie, and that was Easy A. And so I just wonder, you know, for people who haven't seen it yet, I guess it's often described as like a modern version of The Scarlet Letter, and you're Hester and all of that. And I just wonder, how early on did you see that was a special opportunity? Because I think you fought for the audition, no?
Right away. I saw right away. Yeah, I did. There was another fighting for it.
Yeah.
A presentational moment. I remember Tom McNulty, who was a producer on a movie called The Rocker, sent me over the script secretly, like early on, I think a year before they were even auditioning for it, and just said, I read this and I really think you should take a look at this. It was written by Burt V. Royal, who wrote an amazing play called Dog Sees God, and it was so phenomenal. Yeah. I was like, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
And so I sat with that script for quite a while, and then, you know, and Doug Wald, who became my manager after The Partridge Family, I was introduced to him after The Partridge Family. He had nothing to do with the production, but he's my manager to this day. We just kept an eye on it, and it started, you know, the auditions were kind of announced, and I was the first person to audition.
Yeah, yeah. And was that a quicker yes for you on that one, or did you also have to wait forever to hear about
that? That happened relatively quickly, yeah.
And the way it was made, it sounds like it was a little unusual. I read about cameras rolling for takes that were as long as 30 minutes. Why would that have been? Is that correct?
On Easy A?
Yeah.
Well, we were shooting on digital. So I think because Will Gluck, who just became like I don't know how I would have survived that movie without Will. He was just the greatest, greatest partner and friend in the world. He was constantly throwing things at me. While we were rolling. And yeah. I mean, God, that footage is probably insane because we fought like cats and dogs in like a joking way.
Right,
but we were like brother and sister. Yeah. So it's like, no, Will, no. I think I said cut at one point. I mean, just horrible. It was just madness. I was 20 and, you know, out of my comfort zone. But it was really special because we had this sort of freedom. I think maybe it was the first time that I'd ever had that experience of like just continually rolling and and going for it.
And you liked it?
I did like it.
Except at times when you guys, sounds like you may have, probably it's not fun to have people yelling at you when you're acting or shouting direction at you.
No, yeah. It was actually great. It was totally our relationship. I appreciate it so much. It was, yeah. He understood Olive better than I ever could. I mean, he's the real Olive.
Right.
So it was super helpful.
So the movie comes out very well received, and it must have changed your life in a major way, because I would guess after that, whatever anonymity you still had was probably out the window, right?
Well, it was funny because it went in stages. After Superbad came out, people would say, did we go to school together? Or if they really, really could tell, I remember someone shouting across a mall at me once, hey, Jules, you DTF? But that was kind of the extent of it, you know? It wasn't ever really my name or anything like that. And then after a little bit of time, you know, after like Zombieland, there would be some kind of, you know, hey, aren't you that girl from that thing? Can you list me your filmography and maybe I'll know some. But after Easy A, it was a little more, you know, people would say my name, and it was very, very bizarre. Yeah, it was a very strange adjustment.
And did you get out of town after Easy A? Is that when you moved to?
I moved to New York. Yeah, right after shooting Easy A.
Was that a response to anything, or you just were thinking about it anyway?
I don't think it was a response to any anonymity concerns.
Yes. Yes.
I just felt a little, I'd always wanted to live in New York since I was a kid. I went to New York for the first time, I think when I was 7 or 8 in that phase with my mom to see plays. And it just felt like that was the time, that was the opportunity. I turned 21 and I've lived there ever since.
So I guess probably as a result of EZA, but maybe it was independently. You had a very big 2011, the year after, where, first of all, I think with Crazy Stupid Love, and then with The Help, both of which were huge hits. And with Crazy Stupid Love, that was the first time, I guess, you probably crossed paths with Ryan Gosling,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
That was an audition, or how did you, were you guys, I think there was some kind of chemistry read or something with you two, wasn't there, where you guys got to improv a bit?
Yes, there was a chemistry read where I came in and my voice was gone. Apparently I still could talk, but I don't remember talking all that much. And we were with John and Glenn, the directors, and we kind of just, you know, I remember reading a scene, but Ryan had come up with this idea, which made it into the movie, of a dirty dancing lift.
Yes.
And so in the room, we did a little attempted dirty dancing lift. I mean, I don't think it was a full version of it, because on the day, I it really freaked me out and I couldn't actually go through with the lift.
Right.
It had to be a stunt double, but there was the attempt. And I think they just, you know, we got to improvise a little bit and they just sort of felt our, I don't know, camaraderie, I guess.
And did you feel like it was anything unusual? Because again, just to contextualize it for people, this would be the first of three. The second would be Gangster Squad, and now obviously La La Land. Did anything feel kind of like you guys were working well together more than it would have with anyone else that time, or did it take a little while?
I think there was an instant ease kind of to our rapport, but I don't know. As I walked out of the audition room, another actress was walking in. So
right.
I was like, oh, well, all right, you know, never mind.
Right.
I'm sure, you know, I mean, I think Ryan, I read a quote one time that said Ryan could have chemistry with a brick wall. And I think that's very true. Like he makes it very easy.
So the other one that I mentioned is The Help, which I would guess has got to be a very rare thing for you where you're pretty much surrounded by women on a movie, which has that happened at any other time in your career? Certainly not to that degree, right?
No, I'm about to do a movie with women, which I'm very excited about.
Which one is this?
The Favorite, the Yorgos Lanthimos movie.
Oh, cool.
I'm about to shoot
awesome.
In London, and it's a pretty great female situation on that movie. But it's been very rare.
And was The Help, you know, in the making of it, anything special? You know,
a lot of
probably people that became. It seems like everybody became close on that one.
It was outstandingly special. I mean, still to this day, I speak to most of the people from that movie. And
two of them are nominated with you this year, Viola and Octavia.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
And Bryce was at the SAG Awards and Jessica at the Golden Globes. And it's just so much fun to see everybody. And we had a really, really incredible experience. And also because we were in this little town in Greenwood, Mississippi, and we could bike to each other's houses. And we were having this kind of great location based friendship, which can happen on movies when you're stuck in this little town, but you're not stuck at all
because
these are the people that you are spending all your time with. And it was a joy.
It's great.
Bourbon and white wine spritzers and too many mosquitoes.
Well,
not bad.
A year later was, I believe, your first time working with sort of a really within the big studio machine and doing CGI acting and doing some of those things when you agreed to do Spider-Man. This reboot of it. And I just wonder how that came about and what you made of it.
I don't think that wasn't like an outlined goal to go and, you know, be part of a Spider-Man movie or a kind of a superhero world in any way originally. And I had worked with Sony quite a few times on Superbad and House Bunny and Zombieland, EZA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew them pretty well. And they had asked if I would come in and do a screen test. And I think I fought it for a little bit because I was like, I just don't, you know, I don't know the comic that well. And I just don't, I don't know. And then eventually I was like, all right, what's the harm in that? You know, you get to go act and why not?
Mm-hmm.
It's an audition. And so I went in and I auditioned with Andrew and with Mark Webb. And it was a full-on camera test. I mean, I was in the wig and a costume and we were on basically a set.
Right.
And I was acting with Andrew, and I was just, after that, I was like, I can't imagine not doing this.
Right.
Like, this is fantastic. You know, Andrew's such a ridiculously incredible actor.
And you just met at that
test.
Yeah,
at the camera test.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was just, it just felt so exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Andrew, a few weeks ago, was on this podcast, and one of the things that he said was that it had been for him actually a lifelong dream to do Spider-Man because he'd grown up with it and early, you know, pictures of him in the costume and everything. But that very frustratingly for him, the making of it and the realization of it because of corporate considerations ended up being very frustrating and disappointing for him. He loved working with you. He made that very clear, but the rest of it was not what he expected. Could you relate to that?
I think my experience was different in a way because I wasn't in the suit. Mm-hmm. And his dedication to the character and the process of that kind of unfolding, he understandably had different pressures than I did. Gwen's story was always basically outlined to me. I knew what her story was in the comic. I knew that she was going to die in the second film. I knew, sorry, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, I die. But I had sort of a different challenge on the movie of sort of, you know, embodying this woman and bringing her to life in a way that felt, you know, vibrant and connected to that character. So I, in all honesty, I think what I sat with was very different mm-hmm. than what he sat with. And I really enjoyed working with Mark mm-hmm. and with Tolmac and Avi, and you know, those that crew was really fantastic. And obviously Andrew.
Yeah.
So I had a simpler road ahead of me. Yeah.
I read that you are someone who grew up worshiping Diane Keaton mm-hmm. and who is obviously the ultimate Woody Allen muse, among other things. And so what did it mean to you to get the chance, I guess, pretty much right after the Spider-Man movies, to work with him as his newest, you know, leading lady in back-to-back movies, Magic in the Moonlight and then Irrational Man? And by the way, I think Magic in the Moonlight got a little bit of a raw deal. It's underappreciated. I thought it was great. And I don't know why, you know, people love to compare Woody's movies to past movies or different. I don't know. Sometimes he's not judged in a fair way. But I just wonder, you know, back to you, getting the call that Woody's interested in and then doing it. What'd you make of all that?
It was a really interesting time. I had a really good experience on set and became very close actually to that cast, especially Magic in the Moonlight.
Yeah. Was it one of these things where, because you always hear about his auditions are, you know, you walk in and he's like barely looks up and then you're out. But I mean, you were going to be central to these movies, so I would assume it was a little more involved.
No.
No?
It was a very short meeting.
It's such a...
Yeah, that was that.
Had you been prepped for that possibility?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had been told.
Yeah. But yeah. he, as a... Can you pinpoint why, particularly with women, because nobody has ever directed more women to Oscar nominations and also just great performances. What is it with, you think it's in the writing or the directing with him?
Well, he makes a movie every year.
Mm-hmm. That helps you when you're so making it.
Yeah, there's a lot of projects.
Right. It'll help your batting average. Yeah. Okay, so Birdman, in which you play Michael Keaton's rebellious daughter, I guess we could call her. Is that fair
rebellious
to say?
Daughter.
Yes.
I think that's fair
okay.
to say.
Okay. So that one, the way it was made, as most people know, I know it wasn't actually one continuous long shot, but they were very long takes and very specific, intricate mandates for the actors. And he was somebody who was the first to say that he was still mastering his English. What was that like for you to be sort of obviously creative? And, you know, you're there because you're talented and you're creative, but you're also filling a particular need, a very specific need that applies to the cinematographer and all these other things. How did you feel doing that movie?
Well, it definitely was very technically precise. We had a bit of time for rehearsal and we knew what our basic blocking was going to be, but nothing can really prepare you for on the day.
Yeah.
When you're sitting on a rooftop, you know, attached to a harness.
Right.
And someone's coming behind you while the camera moves around and unhooks you from the harness so you can get down and, you know, try to have some moment of connection with right. Edward Norton. Nobody prepares you for that. That is not something that
right.
you learn.
Right. Right.
Or at least I hadn't.
Right.
But then again, you know, as I mentioned, I wasn't very trained.
Yes.
So maybe you do learn that in traditional drama school. Yeah, it was fascinating. It was something that at first was horrifying and I developed a bit of an eye twitch and by the end became addictive and super liberating. And I think fueled the excitement to do something eventually, which maybe you're leading to, mm-hmm. but something like La La Land, mm-hmm. because that sort of technical precision, for some reason, once it clicks into your body, you get to be very free within it, and you don't really, you know, you're not thinking about what do I do with my hands.
Right. Well, one random thought that comes back to me now from when I was watching that movie is that, you know, I wouldn't be the first person to remark upon the fact you have unusually large eyes, right? and I wondered, people were trying to figure out what this movie was about. Everybody was trying to decipher. You're up on the roof, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the way it was described, perched up on the roof, all this stuff. Started to think, like, did he give you subtextual direction there so that you understood? It may sound absolutely insane, but I was thinking, you know, the daughter of Birdman is basically like a large-eyed bird perched up on the roof. Not that I know what that would mean, but I couldn't help but think about, like...
He did not mention that to me. I think Chivo did at one point admit to me that he had never shot a human being on that lens. Chivo is Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer.
Was it accentuating your eyes? Or
yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think it was almost that kind of borderline fisheye sort of situation. And he was so close to my face.
Right.
So I think it did accentuate what's already there, which is, you know, just the sheer out of whackness of my facial proportions.
It's great.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Alejandro has never quite explained that to me.
Yeah.
If that was the intention, I think...
It might just be my
insanity.
You're a real
film professor.
I don't know. So when you guys were doing this, though, just to remind people, it was sort of pre-resurgence of Michael Keaton, now it's like, oh, Birdman, that won Best Picture, just sort of take it for granted. Did you have any suspicion that it could be received as well as it ended up being, where you end up getting a nomination, the movie, as I say, wins Picture and director, and all of these, this just sort of massive acclaim?
I mean, no way, in the sense of how it would be ultimately received, I think, awards wise. But when it came to the film itself, I mean, Alejandro, I was such a fan of, and then Chivo is clearly incredibly brilliant. So that the team behind it, I think, was comforting to do something so sort of ambitious and
different.
Insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, that's pretty much all, you know, I started to realize that as time has gone on, I've started to realize that the journey of it is really as far as you can get, because there is no way of knowing.
You can never predict. In the midst of promoting that movie, because I remember I was doing a Q&A in New York with you and the whole cast and Alejandro, and you were kind of a little anxious because you were just about to start on Broadway doing Cabaret. And you ended up doing that for 3 months, just over 3 months. And what was the root of that? Had you had any prior musical experience or inclinations or desires? And how did it even just come about?
I, growing up in youth theater, loved doing musicals, but could not maintain my voice to save my life. And as you can probably hear.
It's
an interesting operating system with my voice, because it it goes so quickly. So when I was growing up and doing musicals, I just lost my voice all the time, and it was, I probably wasn't singing correctly, which I learned later on a bit more, how to sing a little bit more correctly, although I would not call myself a singer, but I always loved it. I went and saw a lot of musicals, and one of the musicals I saw was the 98 production of Cabaret. Yeah. So
with Alan Cumming, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny.
So it was something I had always wanted to do. Sally Bowles, I think, was the ultimate part to me.
Right.
I mean, it's just the greatest. I remember Rob Marshall telling me, it's Hamlet for women.
Right.
Sally Bowles is Hamlet for women. And it really does feel like that. You go through so much as that character, and it's just, you go from complete joy to hurtling toward death, basically. Yeah. And it was fantastic to get the opportunity.
I was lucky enough to see you do it. And that was at Studio 54, where they transformed it into a cabaret, the Kit Kat Club. You've said that it was, quote, the single greatest experience, close quote, of your career, at least up to that point. Was it just
outside of hosting SNL? Yeah.
Well, that's pretty great too, I bet. Yeah. But with Cabaret, and you know, the idea of, I guess it was probably eight shows a week you guys were doing, or seven or eight. But
eight.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that makes that so appealing? And you know, I think a non-actor might hear that and they say, you got to do the same thing 8 times a week for 3 hours, and you know, doesn't it get boring or repetitive or whatever? Why is every actor who does theater, they virtually all say that if they had to choose between theater and film, they would choose the theater experience.
I think it's a couple things. One is the sense of doing it all together and the live audience and directing yourself, all of which doesn't get to happen much on film. You really have to calibrate what's happening and be very present to the people around you. And the reaction changes every night. The feeling in the theater changes every night. And the second would be, yes, when you're doing the same thing 8 times a week, it does get boring and repetitive. And it's the difference between a long-term relationship and a short-term relationship. It's like if you're into monogamy,
right,
you start to find you're like, okay, this, you know, the theater experience is like a person you've been with for a very long time where you're like, all right, I got to find all these things that are great about you and rediscover it and re-fall in love with you. And then, oh my God, today I see you for the first time. Right. And now I, you know, and it's, I find that much more rewarding, the long-term relationship, yes, than the short-term, but not to say that I find theater much more rewarding than film, because I actually don't. I think that theater was, it would be very hard for me what you just said, choosing theater over, right, over film. I think that doing cabaret informed my next experience, which was La La Land,
right,
and then Battle of the Sexes, so much. It just changed me on a fundamental level of being less of a perfectionist, like I was describing earlier, because you cannot be perfect when you do show 8 times a week. You screw up every single night and then you get to do it again the next day.
Had that also sort of been almost set up with Birdman, which is set in the theater, but basically the thing with Birdman, I read about one instance where you maybe got most pissed of all times at Alejandro for being vague about what he wanted, and then when you just kind of let loose, it happened, right?
Yeah, there was kind of a little breakthrough that happened on Birdman. And he could see it right away. And I was like, you genius. Damn you, you genius. He saw it right away.
Right.
Which is always a great feeling when a director can see what you're doing, yeah, and when you're bullshitting, right, and what you're hiding. And he can. Yeah, I think that process is so... I can't imagine not doing theater for the rest of time.
So you'll go back and forth.
I would truly hope so.
Yeah.
I would absolutely love to.
So it was while you were just getting your footing with cabaret that you first heard from Damien Chazelle?
Yes, during cabaret.
What was
he came
what's
to see
the
out?
Did you know him? What brought that about? Again, you're not somebody who prior to that had done much professionally in the way of music, and yet he was presumably going there thinking about La La Land, right?
Apparently. He came and he saw the play with Justin Hurwitz, the composer, mm-hmm, of La La Land, and I think the music supervisor. And then we went and we got lunch and he told me about La La Land. And he'd come to a performance of cabaret that I thought was, you know, one of my 100 worst. Right. And of, you know, 112 or whatever, right, it was. I was relatively shocked that we were even talking. But yeah, so I've switched my memory of it, because I always thought he came after we talked, but apparently he came before and still wanted to talk to me, which is freaky.
Right.
So we had lunch. He told me about La La Land, and then I read it. And at that time, I think because I was so sick and probably on some version of steroids,
right,
to maintain,
right,
my voice, I was just really taken aback at the idea of doing a musical.
Right, right.
So the timing was actually strangely not great, right, in that moment, because you would think that doing a musical every night would draw you further into it.
So was it actually an offer, and was yours not immediately a yes? Or like what was the status of the at the time of the conversation?
It took us a couple months.
To figure out, both of you.
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we talked a lot. We met up a lot of times. He played the score for me. He talked me through all the visuals of the film. And it was just while I was doing the play, and then it was Birdman and Whiplash, kind of like January and February,
yeah,
we would
same
see
year,
each other,
right,
at,
yeah,
these events. And we would talk and kind of hang and just be like, all right, well, we got to talk again soon.
Right.
You know, we got a lot,
right,
to talk about. It was very hard for me to conceptualize the tone of La La Land, mm-hmm, at first, because I didn't really understand how it could all be cohesive. And so really did. He was so patient with me. I really had about a billion questions for him.
Well, because, yeah, I mean, when was the last, what could he reference that would help you to understand what it would be.
I mean, like Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Yeah, and right, I was right.
That's a few years ago.
Okay, yeah. Singing in the Rain. Right. I'm not sure if Boogie Nights. Well, right. That's interesting. Like, it was right. Just, you know, all these kinds of, you know, amazing but lightly disconcerting references. But Whiplash was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he was so fantastic and so open and honest and kind of instantly collaborative that it became pretty easy to trust him and know that he was going to make his presentation.
Yes. Yeah.
He had his presentation.
Very good. Very good. Well, I mean, also I'm wondering when you're reading the script for the first time and you're seeing the story of a girl with a dream who leaves her home and schleps all the way to Hollywood, perseveres through a few setbacks over a period of years, and then realizes her dream. I mean, I guess anyone that he might be talking to, most people that he might offer the role to could relate probably to that in some way.
Absolutely.
But for you, are you saying, like, I do understand this person?
I mean, yeah, I do. I do understand a lot of what Mia's going through. You know, I had, and we spoke about this at length through our rehearsal process and kind of working together on the character and developing the character in some ways. I was 15, 16, 17 when this was right. going on. Mia is in her mid to late 20s as this is happening, and that's a very different experience. It's one thing to be 15 and wide-eyed and know that you can still hopefully go off to college right. after all of this, and you know all your friends are still in high school, and isn't this cool
right.
that I get to audition and do this? But Mia's experience of making ends meet and the way she's working and all of that was, you know, it was different, mm-hmm. obviously, than my experience in that way.
When you signed on, was it concurrent with Ryan signing on, or did you already know he was on, or had it, or did you precede him?
Ultimately, I had been talking to Damien for quite a while. Ryan sat down with Damien, I think maybe to talk about the film they're doing now, they're about to do.
Which one is that?
For The First Man, Neil Armstrong.
You're going to let him go off without you? We can't find a role in space for you?
Oh, trust me. I have been very vocal yes. about my displeasure right. with yes. this setup.
Yes. Yes.
It's the whole same crew. I do not feel good.
No,
anyway.
No,
no. No, I'm very happy yes. for them. I know yes. they'll make an amazing movie. I'm very angry, though. Yeah. I feel very left out. I think he sat down and spoke to him about that, and somehow this came up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spoke to each other, and yeah, and within the same probably week
so
or two.
So you and Ryan, though, consulted with each other, are we crazy to do this, or are we...
Well, I had no idea that he'd spoken to Ryan, so it was kind of a shocking turn of events.
Okay. So the other thing that would be, I guess, really unusual about signing on to do La La Land is that there was a... Normally, how much rehearsal do you have on a movie, if any?
None,
right?
I mean, for Birdman, we had 3 weeks, and we were like, that's astronomical.
Right. And that was probably largely technical, just mapping out how you're going to do it, right? Like,
oh, but no, he's also seen stuff and you know.
With Birdman.
Oh, yeah.
So now with La La Land, though, I guess at the outset, they must have said, like, we're going to need 3 months of your time.
We wanted 6.
Really?
We wanted a year.
Right.
I think one of the reasons that Damien probably felt okay with us at the end of the day is that I think both Ryan and I were begging for more and more rehearsal time. I mean, we really wanted to we wanted to go for it for as long as possible.
And those 3 months encompassed what?
Learning to tap and ballroom dance, singing lessons for me, piano lessons for Ryan, a lot of scene work with Damien, a lot of character development.
Which came out of your own experiences often, right?
Yeah. The first audition in the movie is Ryan's experience. I'm very grateful to right. have gotten the opportunity to incorporate that into the movie. And just a lot of, you know, we watched movies as a cast and crew.
What were these were like references that you should be
Well, Umbrellas of Cherbourg was our big one. That was, I hadn't seen it up until that point. And,
right.
Had seen bits of it because Damien had referenced it, and it was just so fun to see it projected onto a wall with all of us together eating pizza and, you know, having this kind of iconic cinematic experience together.
And I don't know if this was another one, another sort of movie that he wanted you to see, but, you know, the idea of you guys being teamed for the third time in a movie when other past musicals had Astaire and Rogers or whoever recurrently were those ones that you also looked at.
Top Hat was a big reference.
Yeah.
Isn't It a Lovely Day to Get Caught in the Rain was something that we were very kind of attached to for the Lovely Night sort of duet on the hill.
More so than Singing in the Rain.
Well, I mean, yes and no. There's, you know, Singing in the Rain was deeply inspiring. It was very hard. You know, it's one thing with Ginger Rogers to look at her and go, okay, well, she was dancing since she was a little girl.
Right.
She is a very professional dancer. Right. I'm not going to throw myself, you know, against Ginger Rogers. But then I look at Debbie Reynolds and I hear she learned to dance for Singing in the Rain. And I go, damn it. Debbie Reynolds is the greatest. I cannot even. I mean, she learned to dance in a matter of weeks at 19 next to Gene Kelly. So I can't hold a candle to her. So watching that, you know, watching Singing in the Rain was more feeling bowled over than anything. I mean, I don't think we were going, well, we got to match up to that, you know.
But the other one that I wondered just about that, you know, what did you, how'd you describe it? The duet that's up there where you, where you're looking for your cars.
Yeah, Lovely Night.
Lovely Night. Mm-hmm. The way it was shot, and like many of the things in the movie, but particularly that one, was reminded me of The Bandwagon, because the great thing they did there was they show your full body the whole time, because they don't want any question that there's a double doing your moves for you or whatever.
Absolutely.
And you guys had to do that too.
That was something Damien was deeply attached to from the beginning, and he made very clear. And we went over to Patricia Kelly's house, who's Gene Kelly's widow, Ryan, Damien, Mandy Moore, our choreographer, and me. I apologize to all of you at home who care about grammar for any mistakes I may have made. I just remember being at her house having dinner, and she was talking about Gene Kelly saying how important it was to shoot the entirety of a dancer's body so that it's not, you know, chopped up in that way. And
like everything today is, if you were to watch a music video or whatever.
Well, yeah, I guess it just depends on what style you're going for, but That was deeply important to Damien.
As awesome as those complex numbers were to watch, I actually thought additionally, though, some of the moments, which I don't know how much improv was encouraged on this movie, but, and I don't know if this would have even been improv, but like there's a scene where the camera kind of comes in on you guys at the piano and you're singing, I guess it was City of Stars, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. It felt, and like a lot of moments, but that one in particular, watching it, I just feel like you guys almost weren't told the camera was on or something. It just feels very natural and real. And so was there any degree of improv stuff in, or at least in the moment, improv stuff in this movie?
There were, Damien was definitely open to exploring a bit. We, for the most part, I would say that we improvised kind of together and would do that in the rehearsal room with Damien. He would sort of take what we had done and find ways to sort of filter it into the dialogue if it helped that kind of relationship unfold. But when it comes to like City of Stars, that was not, you know, that wasn't improvised. That was just the song. And that was just what we did in the one shot.
That's like your method. As time goes by, or you're hearing it throughout the film in just different ways and whatever. But the other song, in addition to City of Stars, that's nominated for the movie is Audition, which I think, I don't know if you could have had a better moment to shine and capitalize on it than you did. Just to remind people, this is where your do or die last shot audition is happening, and you start singing about your aunt, and it zooms or the camera itself moves in or whatever it was on you.
He's on a Steadicam. He's really. It was Ari just walking toward me.
doesn't it go past the two people at the table though?
Yeah, they split the
desk.
They
split the table?
So there are guys pulling the desk out and they're moving out of the way. And then he walks towards me and spins around and then walks backwards, and they put the desk back in and raise the lights.
And so the lights actually went down in the room.
I mean, that's all in the camera. That everything you see is just the one shot.
Oh my God. And there
Which
it
was
appears...
the craziness about that desk. the desk was a trip.
What a,
See the desk.
So splitting. Like when we're hearing you guys sing throughout the movie, I guess defining what live singing is might be helpful, because in the audition song, I cannot see anything that would suggest that you weren't literally, that audio was not coming out of that mouth at that moment, right? That was live on the scene.
Yeah.
And probably in other times when you're dancing and having to sing, you loop it in or whatever later.
In A Lovely Night, that was a pre-record, because then we had to go straight into dance. I didn't actually have a mic on for that scene.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But like for the audition number, where again, I think it was the most impressive moment in the whole movie, did that one give you any more apprehension going into it than others?
I mean, a bit.
A little bit, yeah.
It's kind of one of those days that sits on the schedule. Right. Really. That still hasn't happened.
Right, right.
But it was a really special day. The one thing that really still kind of sat with me on that day was knowing, because Justin Hurwitz was playing, or the composer was playing the music in my ear, in an earwig from the other room. So he was moving along with me with my voice. But I just realized everyone in this room is hearing me sing a cappella. And it was not a fun realization that they had to hear me sing this song over and over in a cappella. God. Because the orchestra, the orchestra helps.
It helps a little
bit.
It was pretty, that was pretty great. And were you, just to touch on the other ones that I'm sure you always get asked about, the opening sequence, I know you're part of it, but was it all actually shot sort of like domino effect where the way we see it, where all these things are happening, or was it broken up in a way that you come in after the other stuff was actually done?
Yeah, they panned down to our cars after the dance number was done. So that was a movie. Yeah, that was a stitch.
And what about down to our cars. Technically, again, just because I watched the movie now like 5 times and I always wonder, how did you guys do the Griffith Park floating scene, which is so great as well?
Oh yeah, that was, I think, the only thing that was on a set.
Okay.
And it was just a recreation of the planetarium, and they put us on harnesses and wires, and they, you know, put the stars in against the blue screen. That was pretty much, we just sort of danced through the sky.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you had actually, another fun fact, I believe, done a scene with Ryan in a movie at Griffith Park Observatory.
Yes.
Prior to La La Land,
yes.
Right?
Gangster Squad. Our first day on Gangster Squad, which it was cut from the movie.
But we had
this kind of fun day at Griffith. We were both just so excited to be there. And the whole day, Ryan was searching for James Dean's crowbar, which we didn't know was foreshadowing, you know, 5 years later in our lives, or 4 years later, we would have a whole section of a movie about Rebel Without a Cause.
It's such a great part of the movie.
He's convinced that the crowbar's down there.
It's still there.
It's still there somewhere.
Where the knife fight or whatever actually happens is definitely still there, because I've gone and looked for that, and that's, you can match it up.
The knives?
Well, you know, you're not going to find the actual knives, but the exact spot where he and the actor, Corey Allen, it hasn't changed that much in whatever, 60 years.
It's so cool. It's so, just to be at Griffith, Observatory is a really, like,
oh yeah,
that never, the magic never goes away.
Great date spot.
Yeah.
All right, so when did you see the film for the first time?
I would say spring of this year.
In what sort of a set?
It was 2016. It's 2017 now. Oh, thank God. Yeah. Sort of. Spring of 2016. And when I first saw it, it didn't have traffic at the beginning.
They cut the
traffic number at the beginning, and about 15 minutes in, the roommate sequence began, and they burst into song, and it was so startling because there had been no music or singing or dancing in the film up to that point.
Right.
It was just shocking, and I think they were testing out, you know, because traffic is really the only number in the movie that doesn't really further the story.
Right.
So they were seeing, you know, maybe if all the songs are just something that kind of furthers the plot.
And had there been an overture or something at that point? Because I remember Damien saying at one point there was like 3 false starts.
Originally, there was a full-on old-fashioned overture with title cards and a sort of painting of a palm tree, that the palm tree that you see in the end of the movie, fading into a sunset and the nighttime and then back up to the morning, and that kind of, you know, a very sort of classic title card sequence with the overture.
And then traffic.
And then traffic.
And then,
I think it was just those.
Well, that, so he felt it was redundant to have 2 overtures.
Yeah, it was, I mean, but I always loved that title card sequence idea.
Yeah.
But I think traffic's very important.
I mean,
I think that opening scene is very, very necessary.
Well, you guys opened the whole Golden Globes with that. Mandy, I guess, did that for them, right?
I mean, that blew me away.
So you saw it first with him, but then when the movie actually had its official premiere, you were at Venice for that.
Yeah.
And was that where it was now in the form that we all see it? Was that a different experience?
Yeah. I mean, seeing it with an audience outside of just the crew of the movie, who all were, you know, giving each other big hugs and had worked on this for 6 months.
You weren't getting an objective read.
Right. This was a very different experience. Man, it was a night I'll never forget.
A little emotional.
It was very emotional. Yeah. It was also emotional because Ryan was in Budapest and wasn't there. And, right. you know, a bunch of us were there. And it was just, it was such a bummer not to have him there. But we all just, I mean, we were sweating because there was no air in the theater. And so it was very hot as it was. But I reached over and grabbed Damien's hand after the audition number because my heart was, coming out of my mouth. Right. I thought I was going to faint.
What were you concerned about?
I don't know if I was concerned so much as it was a giant screen with hundreds of people. And I was singing and it was just a lot. Right. It was just a lot. Right. And after the number, I reached over and I reached over Olivia, which I guess is now a common occurrence.
Right.
Now it's a gif, I guess. Right. But I did. I reached over Olivia and grabbed Damien's hand for a second. And it was just pouring sweat. I mean, we were just, you know, beside ourselves.
So first time Americans saw it was at Telluride, although they may have shown it to a few of us before, which was very exciting. And the response ever since then here at home has been, you know, because maybe you could say, oh, Italians, they have their history with musicals or whoever else might, you know. But Americans, who obviously in a lot of ways invented the genre, but then have abandoned it for the most part in recent years, there had to have been some question about, you know, how they were gonna respond to it, how we were gonna respond to it. And yet here we are, I don't know how many weeks after it opened, but it's, we know the critics loved it. We know audiences have loved it. I think it's now well over 200 million worldwide at the box office, which is unthinkable for a musical. And we now know how the Academy feels with record tying 14 nominations, including congratulations for you for Best Actress. So what do you attribute this to? Why is it that at this time in our history, in our culture, whatever it is, why are people so responsive to this movie?
I mean, I can't speak for everybody. I don't know specifically I can only speak for myself, yeah. or what drew me to yeah. it, which was reading it and the experience and making it, you know, being in those, in that beautiful production design or those costumes or dancing to those songs lifted me up but broke my heart. So there was the kind of combination that I personally love most in film, which is something that brings you joy and can make you laugh and make you feel transported in a way, but then has that sort of smallness, that humanness that cuts deep within. That's how I felt mm-hmm. reading it. That's how the ending made me feel. I mean, I cried like a baby reading that ending in the script. And my favorite films have an ending that stays with you for a while. And I think Damien really achieved that with this in the script. And it was trying to live up to that when we were making it. So that's how it affected me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what resonates with people. I think different parts can resonate. It's interesting talking to people because some people describe the film as this really joyous, like kind right. of feel good thing, and some describe it as like very devastating and right. reminds them of Love Lost, and how can there, you know, be anything more painful than, you know, the one that got away. And it's interesting to kind of to hear different perspectives, and it seems to be kind of a different experience for yeah. each person.
Well, the last question is just this: when a movie has been this well received and a performance this well received and all of that, how do you follow it? What's next? I know there's another thing that you're very passionate about that's coming up. So maybe just for, let's pretend somebody somehow had not known about Emma Stone prior to La La Land and now is very anxious to see what's next. What might that be?
Well, I did the Battle of the Sexes. I mean, there's no the. It's just called Battle of the right, Sexes, the right. film. I played Billie Jean King. Right. Steve Carell played Bobby Riggs. And that was a hell of an experience. That was right after La La Land.
First time playing a real
yes.
person.
First time playing a real person, and Billie Jean King is
quite a real person.
So that happened, and then I am, doing this Yorgos Lanthimos movie in a couple weeks.
Are you a different actress than you were when you started La La Land? Is there something that, what's its? We can all leave and, oh, this is its impact on me, or I like the different examples you were citing of people feeling one way or the other, but. For you, ultimately, what's the takeaway going to be in the long run?
I think I'm a different actress from every project I do. There's something, you know, something changes each time or grows each time. And I hope that never ends because I really need to keep growing. Yeah. But I think from La La Land, one of the great gifts that Damien gave me or gave us was, I really do think everyone on that set felt very valued. And it was an experience of collaboration that I had never had before. He was so open to so much sort of, you know, freedom, and there was so much openness to ideas and thoughts and mistakes and jokes and, you know, screw ups. He just had this sort of faith, but a very clear vision that he never lost sight of. And that was very inspiring to see. And I would hope that, you know, that more things can be that way. Yeah. So I definitely took that with me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I love the movie. Love your stuff. It's great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.